classical economics until the 1870s, when it was decisively overthrown by what economists call the theory of marginal utility, the approach to exchange value that dominates modern economics. Ironically, a labor theory survived in the work of Karl Marx, who was extremely well-versed in classical economics and influenced by its theories. We should note, however, that Marx was more influenced by David Ricardo, who sought to restore a pure embodied labor theory of value, than by Adam Smith, who was acutely aware of its difficulties. Adam Smith, despite the problems with his theory of exchange value, penned one of the finest discussions of market price ever written. In a chapter entitled, Of the Natural and Market Price of Commodities, he shows how market prices adjust themselves during market competition. Smith begins by dividing price into three component parts: wages, the price paid to labor; profit, the price paid to capitalists who accumulate stock; and rent, the price paid to landowners.
Whoever derives his revenue from a fund which is his own must draw it either from his labor, from his stock, or from his land. The revenue derived from labor is called wages. That derived from stock, by the person who manages or employs it, is called profit. The revenue which proceeds altogether from land is called rent.
Wages, profit, and rent, Smith argues, tend to level out in the same economic neighborhood, that is, in an area where there are no serious obstacles to hinder exchange, such as high transportation costs. This average level is called the natural rate of wages, profit, and rent. The natural price, contrasted by Smith with the market price, is closely related to his notion of real exchange value. Fortunately, however, it makes sense in its own right without this foundation.
When the price of any commodity is neither more nor less than what is sufficient to pay the rent of the land, the wages of the labor, and the profits of the stock employed in raising, preparing, and bringing it to market according to their natural rates, the commodity is then sold for what may be called its natural price.
The idea behind natural price is fairly simple. Suppose you are considering becoming a brewer of beer. Assuming there is a demand for beer, and there usually is, what factors will you consider before you embark on this venture? Smith isolates three factors. You will consider the cost of rent, the cost of labor, and you will investigate the rate of profit you expect to make in your area of distribution. Add up these three factors, rent, wages, and profit, and you arrive at the natural price of beer in your economic neighborhood. This natural price is the minimum price you expect to get for beer before you take up the occupation of brewer. Of course, the actual market price of beer usually deviates from this natural price. If you are the only brewer in your neighborhood, you may get more than the natural price. In this event, however, other brewers drawn to high profits will enter your market, thus forcing the market price down towards the natural price. Perhaps you, the brewer, misjudged the natural price of beer in your neighborhood, and you were forced to unload it at a market price below the natural price. In this case, you will go out of the brewing business and direct your resources to a more profitable industry.
Though the price, therefore, which leaves him this profit, is not always the lowest at which a dealer may sometimes sell his goods, it is the lowest at which he is likely to sell them for any considerable time, at least where there is perfect liberty, or where he may change his trade as often as he pleases.
The market price, Smith argues, is regulated by the natural price.
The market price of every particular commodity is regulated by the proportion between the quantity which is actually brought to market and the demand of those who are willing to pay the natural price of the commodity, or the whole value of the rent, labor, and profit which must be paid in order to bring it thither.
The market price depends on demand, but Smith distinguishes effectual demand from absolute demand. Effectual demanders are those who want a product and who have the resources necessary to pay the costs and profit of bringing that commodity to market.
Such people may be called the effectual demanders. And their demand, the effectual demand, since it may be sufficient to effectuate the bringing of the commodity to market. It is different from the absolute demand. A very poor man may be said in some sense to have a demand for a coach and six. He might like to have it, but his demand is not an effectual demand, as the commodity can never be brought to market in order to satisfy it.
If you cannot supply enough beer to meet the effectual demand, the market price of beer will rise above the natural price.
When the quantity of any commodity which is brought to market falls short of the effectual demand, all those who are willing to pay the whole value of the rent, wages, and profit, which must be paid in order to bring it thither, cannot be supplied with the quantity which they want. Rather than want it altogether, some of them will be willing to give more. A competition will immediately begin among them, and the market price will rise, more or less, above the natural price.
If, on the other hand, you brew beer in excess of the effectual demand, the market price of beer will fall below the natural price.
When the quantity brought to market exceeds the effectual demand, it cannot be all sold to those who are willing to pay the whole value of the rent, wages, and profit, which must be paid in order to bring it thither. Some part must be sold to those who are willing to pay less, and the low price which they give for it must reduce the price of the whole. The market price will sink, more or less, below the natural price.
The self-interest of producers and consumers, Smith explains, causes this natural regulation of the market price.
The quantity of every commodity brought to market naturally suits itself to the effectual demand. It is the interest of all those who employ their land, labor, or stock in bringing any commodity to market that the quantity never should exceed the effectual demand. And it is the interest of all other people that it never should fall short of that demand.
If, as we said, the supply of a commodity exceeds the effectual demand, the market price will fall below the natural price, and resources will be withdrawn from its production. Smith elaborates on this theme.
If at any time it exceeds the effectual demand, some of the component parts of its price must be paid below their natural rate. If it is rent, the interest of the landlords will immediately prompt them to withdraw a part of their land. And if it is wages or profit, the interest of the labourers in the one case and of their employers in the other will prompt them to withdraw a part of their labour or stock from this employment. The quantity brought to market will soon be no more than sufficient to supply the effectual demand. All the different parts of its price will rise to their natural rate, and the whole price to its natural price.
Smith now applies the same reasoning to the supply of a commodity that cannot meet the effectual demand.
If, on the contrary, the quantity brought to market should at any time fall short of the effectual demand, some of the component parts of its price must rise above their natural rate. If it is rent, the interest of all other landlords will naturally prompt them to prepare more land for the raising of this commodity. If it is wages or profit, the interest of all other labourers and dealers will soon prompt them to employ more labour and stock in preparing and bringing it to market. The quantity brought thither will soon be sufficient to supply the effectual demand. All the different parts of its price will soon sink to their natural rate, and the whole price to its natural price.
Adam Smith wishes to show how a spontaneous economic order regulates the market price of commodities. Amid the continuous fluctuation of market prices, Smith argues, there stands the natural price, drawing market prices to its level.
The natural price, therefore, is, as it were, the central price, to which the prices of all commodities are continually gravitating. Different accidents may sometimes keep them suspended a good deal above it, and sometimes force them down even somewhat below it. But whatever may be the obstacles which hinder them from settling in this centre of repose and continuance, they are constantly tending towards it.
To the untrained eye, the helter-skelter of price fluctuations may appear chaotic. Not so, says Adam Smith. The natural price assures that supply will adjust itself to demand in a free market.
The whole quantity of industry annually employed in order to bring any commodity to market naturally suits itself in this manner to the effectual demand. It naturally aims at bringing always that precise quantity thither which may be sufficient to supply, and, no more than supply, that demand.
It has been said that if you wish to remember the essentials of your class on economics 10 years after you graduate from college, you just need to remember two words, supply and demand. Depending on how interesting you find economics, you may thank or blame Adam Smith for this. Adam Smith has laid down the essentials of his economic theories. Now, in the remainder of Book One, he launches the detailed examination of the three factors of production, labor, capital stock, and land. And he investigates how the revenue of a nation is distributed to these three factors in the form of wages, profit, and rent. Let's take a look at Smith's treatment of wages. Smith opens his discussion of wages with another reference to that original rude state of things which precedes both the appropriation of land and the accumulation of stock. This is a society before specialization and the division of labor, where each worker keeps the whole produce of his labor, small as it is, we might add. With the accumulation of stock, however, comes the division of labor, and with the division of labor comes specialization. And with specialization comes dependence upon others in society, where we can acquire much of what we need only through exchange. Consider the brewer who makes beer. It takes time to produce commodities. The brewer cannot purchase what he needs until he brews his beer and brings it to market. So what is he to do in the meantime? Even supposing the brewer to be a two-fisted sort who can nourish himself on nothing but beer for weeks at a time, how will he furnish his other wants, such as clothing? Unless the brewer has previously accumulated enough stock to sustain himself during the production process, self-interest will lead him to sell his services to a person who has accumulated the necessary capital stock. This person, the master, as Smith calls him, or the capitalist, as we call him today, advances money to the brewer in the form of wages. And just as self-interest causes the brewer to sell his services, so self-interest causes the master to buy these services.
In all arts and manufactures, the greater part of the workmen stand in need of a master to advance them the materials of their work and their wages and maintenance till it be completed. He shares in the produce of their labour, or in the value which it adds to the materials upon which it is bestowed, and in this share consists his profit.
What determines the amount of wages paid to the worker in a market, according to Smith?
What are the common wages of labor depends everywhere upon the contract usually made between those two parties, whose interests are by no means the same. The workmen desire to get as much, the masters to give as little as possible.
Although the master prefers to pay as little as possible, there is an obvious minimum to wages. The worker must be paid enough to sustain him, or he could not work. He must be paid at least a subsistence wage. Understandably, workers are not very happy with subsistence wages. How can they acquire more? Well, they might combine together, form a union, and hold out for higher wages. But Smith is pessimistic about this tactic in the long run. The masters, with their accumulation of stock, can hold out longer than the workers in the bargaining process. In the long run, Smith writes, the workman may be as necessary to his master as his master is to him, but the necessity is not so immediate. Where, then, is the worker's hope for higher wages? In a progressive economy, argues Smith, with increasing wealth. If workers are in demand, masters will compete for them by offering higher than subsistence wages.
When, in any country, the demand for those who live by wages, labourers, journeymen, servants of every kind, is continually increasing, when every year furnishes employment for a greater number than had been employed the year before, the workmen have no occasion to combine in order to raise their wages. The scarcity of hands occasions a competition among masters, who bid against one another in order to get workmen, and thus voluntarily break through the natural combination of masters not to raise wages.
Workers are paid from accumulated capital, and their wages will rise as this capital increases.
The demand for those who live by wages, therefore, necessarily increases with the increase of the revenue and stock of every country, and cannot possibly increase without it. The increase of revenue and stock is the increase of national wealth. The demand for those who live by wages, therefore, naturally increases with the increase of national wealth, and cannot possibly increase without it.
A country may have a vast amount of total wealth, but if its economy has stopped growing, if it has become stationary, the competition for labor will diminish, wages will fall, and workers will find themselves in desperate straits. Smith points to China as an example of a stationary economy, and he paints a grisly picture of the condition of its people.
The poverty of the lower ranks of people in China far surpasses that of the most beggarly nations in Europe. In the neighbourhood of Canton, many hundred, it is commonly said, many thousand families have no habitation on the land, but live constantly in little fishing boats upon the rivers and canals. The subsistence which they find there is so scanty that they are eager to fish up the nastiest garbage thrown overboard from any European ship. Any carrion, the carcass of a dead dog or cat, for example, though half putrid and stinking, is as welcome to them as the most wholesome food to the people of other countries.
In his defense of high wages for labor, a wage, as he puts it, consistent with humanity, Adam Smith was unorthodox for his day. Many economists in Smith's time vigorously advocated subsistence wages, maintaining that higher wages would raise prices and damage a nation's ability to compete in international markets. Smith disagrees. High wages, he says, indicate a prosperous nation.
The liberal reward of labor, therefore, as it is the necessary effect, so it is the natural symptom of increasing national wealth. The scanty maintenance of the laboring poor, on the other hand, is the natural symptom that things are at a stand, and their starving condition that they are going fast backwards.
Defenders of a subsistence wage also argued that if you pay a worker more than he needs to survive, he will become lazy, and his expectations will rise beyond his station. There is a common complaint, Smith says, that luxury extends itself even to the lowest ranks of the people in England, and that the laboring poor will not now be contented with the same food, clothing, and lodging which satisfied them before. Smith's reply to this objection, in effect, is, good for the laboring poor. These workers are entitled to their share of a nation's wealth.
No society can surely be flourishing and happy, of which the far greater part of the members are poor and miserable. It is but equity, besides, that they who feed, clothe, and lodge the whole body of the people should have such a share of the produce of their own labour as to be themselves tolerably well fed, clothed, and lodged.
We have already seen how Adam Smith defends a commercial society and a free market, because he believes the poor will be the greatest beneficiaries. Now he reinforces that conviction.
It is in the progressive state, while the society is advancing to the further acquisition, rather than when it has acquired its full complement of riches, that the condition of the labouring poor, of the great body of the people, seems to be the happiest and the most comfortable. It is hard in the stationary and miserable in the declining state. The progressive state is, in reality, the cheerful and the hearty state to all the different orders of the society. The stationary is dull, the declining melancholy.
After discussing wages, Adam Smith turns his attention to the profits acquired from capital stock. The rise or fall of profits in a society, he argues, depend like wages on the increasing or declining wealth of a society. But profits differ from wages in a crucial way. Whereas wages tend to rise in a progressive economy, profits tend to fall. When competition is unfettered by law, when competitors, attracted by the prospect of gain, are free to enter any manufacture or trade, then profits will level off.
The increase of stock, which raises wages, tends to lower profit. When the stocks of many rich merchants are turned into the same trade, their mutual competition naturally tends to lower its profit. And when there is a like increase of stock in all the different trades carried on in the same society, the same competition must produce the same effect in them all.
Because profits are lessened by free competition, manufacturers and merchants are among the most vociferous advocates of economic regulations and restrictions as a means to hamper competition and keep profits artificially high. These manufacturers and merchants, Smith points out, are also those who complain most about high wages for workers. Smith has some terse words for this self-serving hypocrisy.
Our merchants and master manufacturers complain much of the bad effects of high wages in raising the price and thereby lessening the sale of their goods both at home and abroad. They say nothing concerning the bad effects of high profits. They are silent with regard to the pernicious effects of their own gains. They complain only of those of other people.
Let's pause to consider a criticism often leveled against Adam Smith, especially by opponents of the free market. Smith, it is said, was a naive optimist who believed in a natural harmony of interests. He defended the capitalist and his profits, equating the interest of the capitalist with the good of society. Adam Smith, this argument concludes, ignored the conflict among different economic classes. In view of what we have heard from Adam Smith so far, this claim appears rather silly, and it points up the need to look at what Adam Smith actually said, rather than accept what some critics claim he said. Capitalists, in Smith's opinion, are neither better nor worse than other people. Like other people, they pursue their interests, but unlike other people, their interests are often served by restricting competition. The accumulation of capital stock and the pursuit of profit increase wealth and thereby benefit society, according to Smith. But this benefit does not arise because capitalists are inherently good or trustworthy people. The benefits of capital accumulation and profit-seeking are unintended consequences, and the free market, with its discipline of competition, preserves these unintended benefits. A free, self-regulating market is a mechanism whereby self-interest is channeled for the public good, whatever the motives and intentions of capitalists.
The whole of the advantages and disadvantages of the different employments of labor and stock must, in the same neighborhood, be either perfectly equal or continually tending to equality. If in the same neighborhood there was any employment evidently either more or less advantageous than the rest, so many people would crowd into it in the one case, and so many would desert it in the other, that its advantages would soon return to the level of other employments. This, at least, would be the case in a society where things were left to follow their natural course, where there was perfect liberty, and where every man was perfectly free both to choose what occupation he thought proper and to change it as often as he thought proper. Every man's interest would prompt him to seek the advantageous and to shun the disadvantageous employment.
The competition of a free market, this argument maintains, tends to equalize wages and profits within the same neighborhood. Other things being equal, competition regulates wages and profits, forcing them up or down to their natural rates. This is only a tendency, however. Other conditions cause differentials in wages and profits. Wages may vary, in Smith's words, with the ease or hardship, the cleanliness or dirtiness, the honorableness or dishonorableness of the employment. Or second, they may vary with the easiness and cheapness or the difficulty and expense of learning the business. Or third, the wages of labor in different occupations may vary with the constancy or inconstancy of employment. Smith offers many examples of these different conditions and circumstances that may cause wages to differ, even in the same neighborhood, and his treatment has received considerable praise from modern economists. But as Smith saw the matter, these natural causes were far less significant than the variations brought about artificially by the intervention of government.
Such are the inequalities in the whole of the advantages and disadvantages of the different employments of labor and stock, which the defect of any of the three requisites above mentioned must occasion, even where there is the most perfect liberty. But the policy of Europe, by not leaving things at perfect liberty, occasions other inequalities of much greater importance.
When government intervenes, such as by restricting entry into a profession, the leveling tendency of the market cannot operate normally. If potential competitors, inspired by the hope of high profits, cannot enter a profession freely, thereby lowering profits, then members of that profession will enjoy the reward of legal privileges, high profits shielded from competition. One example given by Smith was especially prevalent in his day. Incorporated trades or guilds, which required a long apprenticeship, usually 7 years, before any person could enter the trade.
The exclusive privilege of an incorporated trade necessarily restrains the competition in the town where it is established to those who are free of the trade. To have served an apprenticeship in the town under a master properly qualified is commonly the necessary requisite for obtaining this freedom. The bylaws of the corporation regulate sometimes the number of apprentices which any master is allowed to have, and almost always the number of years which each apprentice is obliged to serve. The intention of both regulations is to restrain the competition to a much smaller number than might otherwise be disposed to enter into the trade.
Town corporations, by restricting market entry, permitted guild members to enjoy high profits and wages that a free market would not permit. Who suffered from these regulations? Consumers, for one, who otherwise would have enjoyed lower prices. Potential competitors also suffered, especially the poor laborer, who was legally prevented from earning a living in certain occupations. If Adam Smith, the economist, is critical of these restrictions, Adam Smith, the moral philosopher, is outraged. How dare the law tell a poor man he cannot labor to support himself?
The property which every man has in his own labor, as it is the original foundation of all other property, so it is the most sacred and inviolable. The patrimony of a poor man lies in the strength and dexterity of his hands. And to hinder him from employing this strength and dexterity in what manner he thinks proper, without injury to his neighbor, is a plain violation of this most sacred property. It is a manifest encroachment upon the just liberty, both of the workman and of those who might be disposed to employ him. As it hinders the one from working at what he thinks proper, so it hinders the others from employing whom they think proper. To judge whether he is fit to be employed may surely be trusted to the discretion of the employers whose interest it so much concerns. The affected anxiety of the lawgiver, lest they should employ an improper person, is evidently as impertinent as it is oppressive.
These privileged guilds, supposedly instituted to benefit consumers, were actually instituted to benefit guild members. About this, Adam Smith has no doubt.
It is to prevent this reduction of price, and consequently of wages and profit, by restraining that free competition which would most certainly occasion it, that all corporations and the greater part of corporation laws have been established.
Smith points out that legally incorporated trades permit merchants and manufacturers to fix high prices and to force everyone in the trade to charge these prices. Perhaps the law cannot and should not try to stop price fixing in a free market, Smith contends, but at least the law should not make it easy.
People of the same trade seldom meet together, even for merriment and diversion, but the conversation ends in a conspiracy against the public, or in some contrivance to raise prices. It is impossible, indeed, to prevent such meetings by any law which either could be executed or would be consistent with liberty and justice. But though the law cannot hinder people of the same trade from sometimes assembling together, it ought to do nothing to facilitate such assemblies, much less to render them necessary.
What about the claim that legally incorporated trades protect the consumer? Smith will have no part of this excuse.
The pretense that corporations are necessary for the better government of the trade is without any foundation. The real and effectual discipline which is exercised over a workman is not that of his corporation, but that of his customers. It is the fear of losing their employment which restrains his frauds and corrects his negligence. An exclusive corporation necessarily weakens the force of this discipline.
After covering wages and profit, Adam Smith considers the rent of land and the distribution of wealth to landowners under various circumstances. There are curious inconsistencies in Smith's account, but we needn't go into details here. For our purpose, the important point about Smith's argument is his conclusion. The landlord, he says, enjoys a real increase in rent in a progressive economy.
Every improvement in the circumstances of the society tends either directly or indirectly to raise the real rent of land, to increase the real wealth of the landlord, his power of purchasing the labor or the produce of the labor of other people.
This is the end of Side 1. Please turn the tape over and begin Side 2. Let's summarize what Adam Smith has done in his discussion of wages, profit, and rent. These three components of price represent the three great economic classes or orders in society: laborers, capitalists, and landowners. Adam Smith's lengthy discussion of these orders is an effort to spin out a theory of distribution, that is, to show how the wealth of a nation naturally distributes itself to these orders. Book 1 of The Wealth of Nations concludes with an important summary of these classes and their natural interests. Because rents and wages increase in a progressive economy, and because a spontaneous economic order is the foundation of economic progress, both landlords and laborers have a natural interest in a free market. Here is what Smith says about landlords and their relation to economic regulations.
When the public deliberates concerning any regulation of commerce or police, the proprietors of land never can mislead it with a view to promote the interest of their own particular order, at least if they have any tolerable knowledge of that interest. They are, indeed, too often defective in this tolerable knowledge. They are the only one of the three orders whose revenue costs them neither labor nor care, but comes to them, as it were, of its own accord, and independent of any plan or project of its own. That indolence, which is the natural effect of the ease and security of their situation, renders them too often not only ignorant, but incapable of that application of mind which is necessary in order to foresee and understand the consequences of any public regulation.
Laborers, like landlords, have a natural interest in free, competitive markets.
The interest of the second order, that of those who live by wages, is as strictly connected with the interest of the society as that of the first. The wages of the labourer are never so high as when the demand for labour is continually rising, or when the quantity employed is every year increasing considerably. When this real wealth of the society becomes stationary, his wages are soon reduced to what is barely enough to enable him to bring up a family or to continue the race of labourers. When the society declines, they fall even below this.
Labourers in Smith's day constituted the largest economic order. Why then were they not more effective in implementing their interests by overthrowing mercantilist regulations? Here is Smith's answer.
But though the interest of the labourer is strictly connected with that of the society, he is incapable either of comprehending that interest or of understanding its connection with his own. His condition leaves him no time to receive the necessary information, and his education and habits are commonly such as to render him unfit to judge, even though he was fully informed. In the public deliberations, therefore, his voice is little heard and less regarded, except upon some particular occasions when his clamour is animated, set on and supported by his employers, not for his, but for their own particular purposes.
Finally, we arrive at the last great economic order, merchants and manufacturers, those who live by profit. Recall that, according to Smith, profits decline in a progressive economy, so the order that lives by profit has a natural interest to restrict competition.
Employers constitute the third order, that of those who live by profit. It is the stock that is employed for the sake of profit which puts into motion the greater part of the useful labour of every society. The plans and projects of the employers of stock regulate and direct all the most important operations of labour, and profit is the end proposed by all those plans and projects. But the rate of profit does not, like rent and wages, rise with the prosperity and fall with the declension of the society. On the contrary, it is naturally low in rich and high in poor countries, and it is always highest in the countries which are going fastest to ruin. The interest of this third order, therefore, has not the same connection with the general interest of the society as that of the other two.
Why has this order been so successful in pursuing its interest? By pushing through mercantilist regulations to restrict trade? Smith has an interesting explanation.
As, during their whole lives, they are engaged in plans and projects, they have frequently more acuteness of understanding than the greater part of country gentlemen. As their thoughts, however, are commonly exercised rather about the interest of their own particular branch of business than about that of the society, their judgment, even when given with the greatest candour, which it has not been upon every occasion, is much more to be depended upon with regard to the former of those two objects than with regard to the latter. The interest of dealers in any particular branch of trade or manufacturers is always in some respects different from, and even opposite to, that of the public.
We said that Adam Smith wrote The Wealth of Nations not as an exercise in economic reasoning for its own sake, but as a practical text to influence public policy. With this in mind, we can understand why he ends Book One, which contains the bulk of his economic theories, with a delineation of the economic orders and their natural interests. Merchants and manufacturers, he believes, have had their way too long in restricting the free market for personal profit. By pointing out how workers and landowners benefit from free trade, Smith hopes to rally these classes against mercantilism. If workers and landowners understand how they benefit from a progressive, expanding economy, Smith hopes they will no longer be misled by the sophistry of trade restrictions and the balance of trade doctrine. Adam Smith, in Book One of The Wealth of Nations, discusses the increase in wealth generated by the division of labor, human labor as a measure of wealth, and how national wealth is distributed to the three great economic orders. Book 2 of The Nature, Accumulation, and Employment of Stock takes up the second great cause of wealth, the amount of capital stock in a nation, which determines its rate of employment. The greater a nation's capital stock, the more people it can employ in productive labor. As usual, Smith begins his discussion by referring to that early, rude state of society before the division of labor.
In that rude state of society, in which there is no division of labor, in which exchanges are seldom made, and in which every man provides everything for himself, it is not necessary that any stock should be accumulated or stored up beforehand in order to carry on the business of the society. When he is hungry, he goes to the forest to hunt. When his coat is worn out, he clothes himself with the skin of the first large animal he kills. And when his hut begins to go to ruin, he repairs it, as well as he can, with the trees and the turf that are nearest it.
As the division of labor and specialization advance, as people depend more on exchange with others, the stock of society must increase as well. If a man specializes and cannot supply his own wants, there must be capital stock to sustain him while he works to bring his goods to market.
A weaver cannot apply himself entirely to his particular business unless there is beforehand stored up somewhere, either in his own possession or in that of some other person, a stock sufficient to maintain him and to supply him with the materials and tools of his work, till he has not only completed but sold his web. This accumulation must, evidently, be previous to his applying his industry for so long a time to such a peculiar business.
Earlier, in Book 1, Smith suggested that the division of labor is the basic cause of increasing national wealth. Now, he backtracks and qualifies this assertion. Capital accumulation, he argues, must occur before the division of labor. Once this process has begun, capital accumulation and the division of labor go hand in hand.
As the accumulation of stock must, in the nature of things, be previous to the division of labor, so labor can be more and more subdivided in proportion only as stock is previously more and more accumulated. The quantity of materials which the same number of people can work up increases in a great proportion as labor comes to be more and more subdivided. And as the operations of each workman are gradually reduced to a greater degree of simplicity, a variety of new machines come to be invented for facilitating and abridging those operations. As the division of labor advances, therefore, in order to give constant employment to an equal number of workmen, an equal stock of provisions and a greater stock of materials and tools than what would have been necessary in a ruder state of things must be accumulated beforehand. But the number of workmen in every branch of business generally increases with the division of labor in that branch. Or rather, it is the increase of their number which enables them to class and subdivide themselves in this manner.
Smith now elaborates on the role of capital accumulation in furthering national wealth.
As the accumulation of stock is obviously necessary for carrying on this great improvement in the productive powers of labor, so that accumulation naturally leads to this improvement. The person who employs his stock in maintaining labor necessarily wishes to employ it in such a manner as to produce as great a quantity of work as possible. He endeavors, therefore, both to make among his workmen the most proper distribution of employment and to furnish them with the best machines which he can either invent or afford to purchase. His abilities in both these respects are generally in proportion to the extent of his stock, or to the number of people whom it can employ. The quantity of industry, therefore, not only increases in every country with the increase of the stock which employs it, but, in consequence of that increase, the same quantity of industry produces a much greater quantity of work. Such are, in general, the effects of the increase of stock upon industry and its productive powers.
Some aspects of Smith's theory of capital, such as his distinction between fixed and circulating capital, greatly influenced later economists. This is also true of Smith's approach to money, which he calls the great wheel of circulation. Smith takes this opportunity to reinforce a point that becomes essential to his attack on mercantilism. Real wealth, Smith says, does not consist in money, but in what money can buy. Real revenue for an individual and for a nation consists of the power of purchasing or consuming.
Though the weekly or yearly revenue of all the different inhabitants of any country may be, and in reality frequently is, paid to them in money, their real riches, however, the real weekly or yearly revenue of all of them taken together, must always be great or small in proportion to the quantity of consumable goods which they can, all of them, purchase with this money.
Perhaps the most curious part of Book Two is Smith's distinction between productive and unproductive labor. One kind of labor, Smith says, adds value to the subject on which it is bestowed. This is productive labor. Another kind of labor has no such effect. This is unproductive labor. Thus, the labor of a manufacturer generally adds value to the material he works on, and so is called productive labor. The labor of a menial servant, however, doesn't add value to any commodity, and so is called unproductive labor. This is not an attack on menial servants. Rather, it is an effort to develop a distinction consistent with Smith's view of exchangeable value and capital accumulation. A manufacturer, Smith says, adds value to a saleable commodity, which can later command an equal value of labor in the marketplace. The labor of a servant, on the contrary, perishes as it is performed and leaves no trace of exchangeable value behind. Unproductive laborers, in Smith's definition, are essentially those employed in service occupations, from the most important to the most trivial. Thus, among unproductive laborers, Smith includes churchmen, lawyers, physicians, scholars, actors, singers, dancers, and even buffoons. Smith is careful to point out that his distinction between productive and unproductive labor has nothing to do with how necessary, useful, or honorable a profession may be. He wishes only to emphasize how these professions produce nothing for which an equal quantity of service can afterwards be procured.
The labor of the meanest of these has a certain value, regulated by the very same principles which regulate that of every other sort of labor. And that of the noblest and most useful produces nothing which could afterwards purchase or procure an equal quantity of labor. Like the declamation of the actor, the harangue of the orator, or the tune of the musician, the work of all of them perishes in the very instant of its production.
The greatest problem here is the label unproductive to describe service occupations. Elsewhere in The Wealth of Nations, Smith implies that all kinds of labor are productive because all kinds of labor have exchange value insofar as they meet the demands of the market. And, as Smith discusses unproductive labor, he concedes that service occupations have economic value and are essential to a nation's well-being. Why, then, does Smith muddy the economic waters with his distinction between productive and unproductive labor? The term unproductive labor is used by Smith as a technical term to describe labor incapable of adding to the capital stock of a nation. Unproductive labor is pure consumption, so to speak, and leaves nothing behind from which more wealth can be generated. There are still serious problems here, but let's try to understand why this issue is important to Smith. If capital accumulation is essential to increase the wealth of a nation, and if productive labor, using the term with its technical meaning, is the only kind of labor capable of augmenting a nation's capital stock, then a nation's wealth will depend on how much of its revenue is channeled into productive labor. If a disproportionate amount of a nation's capital is funneled into unproductive labor, the capital base of that nation will erode, and its wealth will diminish. If a nation's economy is to progress, Smith argues, a good deal of revenue must go to productive labor capable of replenishing its capital stock. Does this mean government, to ensure capital investment, should supervise how individuals spend their money? No, this is precisely the argument Smith wishes to refute. Self-interest alone will ensure sufficient savings and capital investment by individuals. Government, Smith says, is the problem, not the solution, for government itself is the greatest bastion of unproductive labor.
Great nations are never impoverished by private, though they sometimes are by public prodigality and misconduct. The whole, or almost the whole, public revenue is, in most countries, employed in maintaining unproductive hands. Such are the people who compose a numerous and splendid court, a great ecclesiastical establishment, great fleets and armies, who in time of peace produce nothing, and in time of war acquire nothing which can compensate the expense of maintaining them even while the war lasts. Such people, as they themselves produce nothing, are all maintained by the produce of other men's labor.
Governments typically consume large quantities of money with unproductive labor, thereby undercutting a nation's capital structure.
Those unproductive hands, who should be maintained by a part only of the spare revenue of the people, may consume so great a share of their whole revenue, and thereby oblige so great a number to encroach upon their capitals, upon the funds destined for the maintenance of productive labor, that all the frugality and good conduct of individuals may not be able to compensate the waste and degradation of produce occasioned by this violent and forced encroachment.
Despite the spendthrift disposition of governments, Smith hopes that private initiative and industry will save nations from ruin.
The uniform, constant, and uninterrupted effort of every man to better his condition, the principle from which public and national, as well as private opulence, is originally derived, is frequently powerful enough to maintain the natural progress of things toward improvement, in spite both of the extravagance of government and of the greatest errors of administration. Like the unknown principle of animal life, it frequently restores health and vigor to the constitution, in spite not only of the disease, but of the absurd prescriptions of the doctor.
The economic progress of England, Smith argues, was caused by private initiative, not by government spending and regulations.
In the midst of all the exactions of government, this capital has been silently and gradually accumulated by the private frugality and good conduct of individuals. By their universal, continual, and uninterrupted effort to better their own condition. It is this effort, protected by law and allowed by liberty to exert itself in the manner that is most advantageous, which has maintained the progress of England towards opulence and improvement in almost all former times, and which, it is to be hoped, will do so in all future times.
What of the argument that government should watch over the economy and supervise private spending? Adam Smith can barely contain himself.
It is the highest impertinence and presumption, therefore, in kings and ministers to pretend to watch over the economy of private people and to restrain their expense either by sumptuary laws or by prohibiting the importation of foreign luxuries. They are themselves always, and without any exception, the greatest spendthrifts in the society. Let them look well after their own expense, and they may safely trust private people with theirs. If their own extravagance does not ruin the state, that of their subjects never will.
Having marshaled an elaborate case for the free market in Books 1 and 2 of The Wealth of Nations, Adam Smith proceeds in Book 3 to a digression on the history of Europe since the fall of the Roman Empire. Then, in Book 4, he applies his economic principles to the problems of his day. This is where we find his famous attack on mercantilism and its foundation, the balance of trade doctrine, which we have already examined. The division of labor and voluntary exchange, according to Adam Smith, benefit consumers by increasing a nation's wealth. As a foundation for his attack on mercantilist restrictions on trade, Smith applies the same principles to explain how both the international division of labor and voluntary exchange between nations also increase wealth and benefit consumers.
The importation of gold and silver is not the principal, much less the sole benefit which a nation derives from its foreign trade. Between whatever places foreign trade is carried on, they all of them derive two distinct benefits from it. It carries out that surplus part of the produce of their land and labor for which there is no demand among them, and brings back, in return for it, something else for which there is a demand. It gives a value to their superfluities by exchanging them for something else which may satisfy a part of their wants and increase their enjoyments. By means of it, the narrowness of the whole market does not hinder the division of labor in any particular branch of art or manufacture from being carried on to the highest perfection. By opening a more extensive market for whatever part of the produce of their labor may exceed the home consumption, it encourages them to improve its productive powers and to augment its annual produce to the utmost, and thereby to increase the real revenue and wealth of the society. These great and important services foreign trade is continually occupied in performing to all the different countries between which it is carried on.
When Adam Smith treats economic principles, a difficult and abstract subject, he can sometimes be rather dry. But when it comes to attacking mercantilism, Smith writes passionately. Those merchants and manufacturers who engineered trade restrictions violated Smith's economic principles. But more importantly, they also violated his sense of justice. Concerning the mercantilist argument that one nation gains only at the expense of another nation, Smith writes,
"That it was the spirit of monopoly which originally both invented and propagated this doctrine cannot be doubted, and they who first taught it were by no means such fools as they who believed it. In every country it always is and must be the interest of the great body of the people to buy whatever they want of those who sell it cheapest. The proposition is so very manifest that it seems ridiculous to take any pains to prove it, nor could it ever have been called in question had not the interested sophistry of merchants and manufacturers confounded the common sense of mankind. Their interest is, in this respect, directly opposite to that of the great body of the people."
Adam Smith was a great defender of capitalism, if by capitalism we understand a free market and private ownership of capital resources. But as we have seen, Smith was also a determined foe of those who would undercut the free market for personal gain, and he condemns individual capitalists as the worst offenders. Those who regard Adam Smith as an apologist for capitalists would do well to ponder statements like this, which recur throughout The Wealth of Nations.
"The capricious ambition of kings and ministers has not, during the present and preceding century, been more fatal to the repose of Europe than the impertinent jealousy of merchants and manufacturers. The violence and injustice of the rulers of mankind is an ancient evil, for which I am afraid the nature of human affairs can scarce admit a remedy. But the mean rapacity, the monopolizing spirit of merchants and manufacturers, who neither are nor ought to be the rulers of mankind, though it cannot perhaps be corrected, may very easily be prevented from disturbing the tranquility of anybody but themselves."
And how can this mean rapacity of merchants and manufacturers be bridled, according to Adam Smith? By preserving competition in domestic and international trade, thereby instituting a system of natural liberty.
"All systems, either of preference or restraint being thus completely taken away, the obvious and simple system of natural liberty establishes itself of its own accord. Every man,